broadcasting live from... According to all known laws of aviation, there's no way that Jason Statham should be able to fly. His wings are too small to get his bald little head off the ground. This is Pop Culture Reference, your one-stop reference for all things pop culture. I'm one of your hosts, Seamus Connolly.
And I'm Garrett Strother.
And if that weird callback to an animated Jerry Seinfeld movie from a billion years ago didn't tip you off already, today we're covering The Beekeeper, starring Jason Statham. Our first movie released in 2024, is that right?
That is correct. What a way to start off the year, Seamus, let me tell you.
My expectations were so... Like, I barely remembered the trailer for this movie, let's just say. I was just like, yeah, sure, this looks fun. I'm very excited that this is our 2024 inaugural visit to the movie theater. I had a great time. I'm very excited to talk about it.
As am I. But first off, we are going to have to start with our news segment. Starting off with the passing of prolific genre-hopping director Norman Jewison, probably best known for his directorial efforts of In the Heat of the Night, and... arguably the greatest romantic comedy of all time, Moonstruck.
I only saw Moonstruck for the first time in the last few years, and it is truly... It's one of the best movies. It's one of my favorite movies. It's like such a delightful, interesting, funny, weird movie that I had kind of heard of growing up, but never really sat down for. I mean, I also know him for his directing of... the film version of Jesus Christ Superstar, arguably, I think maybe one of the best musical movies of all time. I watched that endlessly growing up. I thought it was so, so good.
Fiddler on the Roof and Justice for All.
I've never seen Rollerball, but I've always wanted to. That looks absolutely demented and amazing. Well, I definitely, if I ever needed any kind of excuse to go back and revisit Moonstruck, which I don't ever really need an excuse, but I think, you know, I've been circling that criterion for Moonstruck for a long time now. I think now is the time.
It's a certified banger. I watched it not 2 weeks ago, and I love it.
It's one of my truly all-time favorite Nick Cage roles, and there's a lot of really, really good ones, but that is such a strange, like, I've never ever seen him, like, I see him in Moonstruck, so for that alone, it is one of my favorites.
What we all know is a bakery boy who had his hand maimed in a baking-related accident. How clearly you can relate to that.
True. When I messed up my hand those few times, who can even remember how many times, I wanted to make the joke, like, nobody would have joined me with that. That would have just been for me.
And after I saw you.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm sure I sent you a text of my wrapped up hand with a big caps text.
Oh, he's so, I mean, truly, that is top five Nick Cage performances in a career full of them. And who is the person second most responsible for that performance who isn't Nick Cage is, of course, Norman Jewison. And if that were his entire career, if Moonstruck were his entire career, that would be enough. But he did give us certified banger after certified banger, and we are grateful to him for it.
Absolutely. But up next in the news here, something we've been hearing rumors about for quite a while now, the announcement of Indiana Jones and the Great Circle, an Xbox-exclusive Indiana Jones video game that was just announced from Bethesda.
Xbox exclusive in quotes because it's also on PC day and date.
Yeah, okay, console Xbox exclusive then, yeah. Maybe. Not on PlayStation is the sad part of that headline, I guess.
Talk to me when I can play it on Wii, like Staff of Kings.
Oh,
then we'll talk.
God. Or do you remember the Staff of Kings, how janky every single version of that? DS, PS2, Wii, it was all a mess, my god.
Which, I think that, I wish you could, like, combine it, if they would just remaster it and put it on PS Plus, I think that would be the ultimate, move. Because if you could fuse all of the versions together, I think you would have a playable game, but unfortunately,
but not. we have this new one coming out, which is, like, first-person, kind of Far Cry-y looking... stuff going on here.
It's Wolfenstein, Seamus. It's first person. It's by the Wolfenstein directors or developers. You're punching Nazis.
I'm kind of into it. I gotta say, I was a little on the fence when I first watched that reveal trailer, but the more I like, I just want to pull out that whip and just use that exclusively throughout the entire game, pretty much.
I am skeptical. I understand completely both for the Wolfenstein-y reasons and also the wanting to separate themselves from certain other adventuring archaeologist video game franchises reasons.
Yeah.
Why this game seems to be in first person. The thing that's really taking me out of it is jumping from first person out to third person cutscenes and like traversal, I think, is really strange. I don't think the name itself is pulpy enough. The Great Circle, what does that mean? Like, I know what it means. They say it in the trailer, but...
Right. But it definitely does not have... it's not Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, the Temple of Doom, for God's sake. Like, that's a name with some chutzpah. You know, I was hoping that it would be a little crazier, like, past Indiana Jones video games, you know, Staff of Kings, Fate of Atlantis. That's huge. That's huge.
And you and I recently had this complaint about Dial of Destiny. I wonder if that's, like, what Disney and Lucasfilm's position is now. Like, no, we don't want too crazy of a name. But I'll say this for this trailer over Dial of Destiny. I could see everything that was going on the screen, and I was less creeped out by Indiana Jones's face.
Oh, man. Troy Baker's doing a good job, too, as Indiana Jones. I actually didn't even recognize his voice when I watched the trailer the first time. I usually can pick up on it pretty quick.
He seems like a good fit for Indy. I liked all the behind-the-scenes mocap looking at stuff that they were showing off. So, will I buy an Xbox for this? It remains to be seen, which I have been threatening to since they announced it. I'm like, they're not going to keep me from playing the Indiana Jones game.
What, don't you own an Xbox? Am I a crazy
person? It's not
coming
out on the last gen. It's only new gen Xbox.
Got it. Right. Yes. I will maybe go half with you. Like, the Xbox is like starting to mount up things I really, really want to play. So maybe we have to do that at some point too, because it would make less sense for us both to buy an Xbox, I think.
We'll have to see what reviews are like, and we'll have to figure out some Indiana Jones video game or something to cover for the show when this comes out, which is allegedly this year. I don't believe it.
Oh my god, yeah. Everyone says they're coming out in 2024, you know, but I actually think that is insane if they think that they'll pull that off.
Famously, you know, Bethesda, we don't have anything to worry about there with crunch.
Yeah, right.
So if they could do it without crunching, I guess I'm open to it. But I'm not in a rush to get this Indiana Jones game. I would rather it, like we say with every video game thing, I would rather it be good and take 2 years to come out.
Yes, absolutely.
But that is all our news for this week. So why don't we go ahead and move on? Oh my god, it's a beehive.
Let's do it. For today's main segment, we are talking The Beekeeper, starring Jason Statham, an honest-to-God thrill ride. I was so happy with this movie. I was not expecting a ton and got everything I ever wanted. It was such a blast. I guess I can stop being unsure that I like just actually love Jason Statham. I'm unapologetically loving Jason Statham's dopey action roles. I'm a big fan.
I think he's terrific in this, and something I enjoy about Statham is that unlike a lot of similar stars, cough cough, Dwayne Johnson, cough cough, he is not afraid to do different personas in movies. Like, I think the character in The Beekeeper feels entirely different than his role in something like The Meg, which is the last Jason Statham thing we covered. Not only that, but what an incredibly different tone for him to take on. I did not know until we got into the theater, but you apparently did, that this movie was directed by David Ayer, which blew my mind. We were watching like the really weird, like almost like horror movie opening credits of quick cuts of found footage of beehives.
It's a wild ride, I will say. But like, don't you kind of see it a little more when they're in the like the call center casino sets, yeah. You know, just a little bit more.
Oh, I see David Ayer all over this movie.
Okay.
I don't mean that in a bad way. I think David Ayer is a talented filmmaker. He's not one of my favorites or anything.
Sure.
I mean, you know how I feel about that Suicide Squad movie, but I don't really feel like that's probably his fault.
No, I wouldn't imagine so.
I really like that this is an action movie with real teeth. You get all kinds of John Wick spin-off, not spin-offs, but the John Wick derivatives.
Yeah.
And of the John Wick derivatives, most of them focus way too much on the lore building and not enough on making good action sequences. And I really appreciate how much this is, one, really its own thing, other than the fact that it's a guy who's in a vague, like, mythology of actiondom killing a billion guys. I don't think it bears that much of a resemblance to John Wick tonally, and I really admire how insanely violent this movie is. It's like an 80s movie. It is
so wild.
I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say it's one of the most violent movies I've ever seen.
Definitely the most violent movie that's like not a straight like slasher movie maybe I've ever seen. It's like so, it was surprising how gory and like truly on screen a lot of this violence is. Mm-hmm. They really like to play around in it a lot, and I kind of loved that too. Usually I feel like taking that much weird satisfaction out of that level of violence would really turn me off to a movie, but this, maybe it's Statham. I don't know. I couldn't explain it to you if I tried, but it just worked. Overall, we were kind of saying it's like if John Wick were dirtier and meaner in general, in tone and in content, in form of violence.
I think there's a couple of things that, I mean, and I totally agree about it being the meaner, grittier version of John Wick, but I think Statham is part of the reason that it doesn't completely turn me off. I think the fact that the movie doesn't completely revel in his violence is something, because sometimes, and I don't want to get too far into spoilers, I do feel like sometimes he is being shown as like a horror movie monster. He is shown as like this insane force of nature that the movie, I don't think, is always of the opinion that the people who he's killing deserve to die. I think a lot of the people it thinks deserve to die, but the movie is aware of his kind of inherently fascist ideology, and something that it does that John Wick does not do is I feel how much Jason Statham wants to kill all these men. Yeah. You were saying as we were leaving the theater, John Wick is so tactical. Two in the chest, one in the head. Get on with your day. And Jason Statham wants these men to suffer. He wants everybody he kills to feel that they're being killed by him.
Yeah, he wants them to die scared. He is truly like we kept saying, like they shoot a lot of those Batman-esque disappearing act scenes where he's just like picking people off as a horror movie. It's so fascinating to see.
All that being said, I think it is really effective in keeping me engaged because I'm like, what is even happening? Why is this happening? In a way, because something like John Wick Chapter 2, which I've complained on this show, I think about being gratuitously indulgent in its violence. It doesn't have the engine that's keeping me engaged with the violence. And this, both tonally, but also just from like a story and character perspective, is keeping me wrapped up enough.
All of that despite the fact that for a good third of this movie's total runtime, when we're following the adjacent FBI case characters that I couldn't even care about a little bit if I tried. Maybe if I tried hard. Despite that fact, I still was really swept up with everything. The questions that I thought might bug me don't even matter a lot of the time. I kind of followed along as we went with also stuff like Josh Hutcherson and his whole realm of this movie. he is absolutely killing it. He's stealing the show, and I love him. Didn't realize that that was the kind of role that he was going for here, but I thought it was a fabulous kind of opposite to how serious Jason Statham's beekeeper character is.
It's always refreshing when a guy who you're used to seeing in franchise movies, you're used to seeing as like kind of the stereotypical leading man role, even if Josh Hutcherson is maybe more known for his like supporting leading man roles. I mean, especially if you look at somebody like PETA, who's known for being like a sweet little dude, when he could just go full weirdo and do a really big swing of a performance, which we'll get more into in spoilers, I loved watching him act in this. And Statham, I think on the flip side, is doing a kind of performance that I've never seen him do before, where he does a couple of lines of dialogue at the very beginning of the movie that tell me a whole story about where his character is emotionally and where he came from emotionally. And it's not that the writing is particularly good, it's that he is emoting in a really deep, pensive way that justifies the rest of the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't sure where it was going in the intro, of course. He has those small moments of like, well, we kind of know what we're in for. We know this is like a crazy action movie. Statham's going to go, he's going to go off. He's going to be very capable, obviously. But those bits in the beginning where we get to see just the seeds of that character's past and where he is in that present as that beekeeper at the beginning of the movie, it's great. It's not overexplained. It's not hit you over the head John Wick 2 style BS. It just is, and it doesn't need to be any more than that as far as I'm concerned, until, you know, maybe we'll get a sequel in here and then it'll get stupid, bloated with beekeeper lore.
I think that if you are prepared for the violence that this movie has, I really do think it's like a Verhoeven-esque level of gore for an action movie. And and you refined my statement well earlier. It's not really one of the most violent movies I've ever seen. It's one of the most violent action movies I've ever seen. That you're going to have a great time. It's a bizarre, rip-roaring ride. I enjoyed it so much. I've been thinking about it nonstop. And you really, really, really should not take your children to this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not. Like, I would even say, you know, you could go see like the Meg level of stuff if you have like a younger person, but yeah. I wouldn't bring anyone under like 13. Anybody, this is no. pretty, it's pretty intense.
It's an R rated. It's like a definitive hard R rated movie. It's not just R because they cuss.
Oh yeah, it is. But again, I definitely want to own a stupid yellow steelbook of this one day when it comes out. I think I would revisit this again. I like it a lot. But I think we should dig into spoilers here. I think we should get into the details. What do you say?
Absolutely agree. Official spoiler warning for The Beekeeper. Seamus, where do you want to start?
God, that's such a hard question with this one, because it's like, Josh Hutcherson is the president's son, and like maybe we should just start with Josh Hutcherson in what is a super dark intro. Has a woman, well, I guess he is inadvertently responsible for a woman shooting herself because she gets scammed out of $2 million, and she's like Jason Statham's kind old grandma, kind of. It's very sad and dark.
It is, and it's crazy that this movie, in what I think is like less than 72 hours, goes from Jason Statham has to avenge his kind neighbor who got scammed, to Jason Statham has to infiltrate the White House and kill the President of the United States, maybe?
Oh, God. Well, it's not even the White House. It's the President's private island house or whatever, crawling with private military and Secret Service.
I leaned over to you during the third act of this movie and said, you know, if all of my teams of military guys were getting taken out by one dude, I think I'd probably go to the White House. That's
yeah. Oh my God. Cause the whole plan of Josh Hutcherson and Jeremy Irons, who we didn't even talk about yet, he's also here. Their whole thing is like, we should hang out around the president because we'll be safe there. And then they immediately go to just like, yeah, somewhere that's not Washington, D.C. in a compound somewhere. Like, it's very foolish.
I think it's kind of supposed to be Camp David or something, vaguely, but they never explicitly say what it is.
She just says the beach house, I think. Just, like, implying, because she's, her whole thing is that she's this, you know, billionaire business owner who gave up her company to her son and Jeremy Irons to run for president and won. So she's obviously some weird, I don't it's hard to read, because at a certain point I'm like, oh, this is like a weird conservative allegory thing where there's like shadow holders of accounts and businesses that are actually still under whatever control, but I don't know. The showdown at the end is genuinely strange.
The politics are very strange.
They're all over the place.
I don't want to dismiss it out of hand by saying that something that deals so directly with the idea of there being rot in government and in the systems that are supposed to protect people in need, I do not want to imply that it is not political, but it does not seem that its politics were thought out in a way that is the primary driver of its plot.
Yeah, because you have to think about those angles of, like, it's a single woman who Jason Statham's climbing this ladder that literally leads directly to the president of the United States.
Yeah.
It's, like, local people to the corporate shell in whatever city to the literal president.
Yeah, it has a weird, it starts out being, you feel like it's kind of a conservative film because it starts out with a deep state, everybody in government is corrupt and taking advantage of everybody else and making money off these shell corporations and everything. And then it seems to tilt a little bit further left when you learn about her corporate ties. At first, you and I both assumed that she was going to be some kind of Trump allegory.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Ended up not being true. And then this skews, like, it's like Sorkin liberalism, where it's like, but she is the president, and she is the only one who's a good enough person to take a stand. So it can't fully condemn the system, but it walks right up to, I mean, the closest you can get probably to fully condemning the system is Jason Statham quick draw shooting Josh Hutcherson in the forehead.
To save the madam president, yeah.
Yeah.
Which she is very upset about, but I mean, you know.
Yeah, who is also Gemma Redgrave, who I think it's weird that they had a British woman playing the American president, but that's...
Oh, she's British? That's very funny. That's very funny. I don't know. I mean, they have a British dude being like an American special op.
Yeah.
Maybe brainwashed to act like a bee. Like, what the... That is where the other half of that... It's like, it might be political, but also they're like, all these beekeeper agents are carrying the literal beekeeping manual, and it's like, yep. Jason Statham's trying to kill the queen, and the queen, that's the president. And you're like, what are they, like, sleeper agents, or why do they actually care about bees?
So I was thinking about this, and there's two things. One, I really actually am very charmed by the whole, like, how much they stick to the bee metaphor, and you're probably right about that informing the plot more than any politics of just him being like, well, there are certain bees that if the queen is producing, what is it, like, ineffectual or defective offspring that will rise up and kill the queen.
It's so literal, it's crazy.
And so I was thinking about this with how Jeremy Irons, Minnie Driver, Jason Statham, obviously, Gemma Redgrave... A lot of British people in this. I was almost like, do you think this was originally supposed to be him making his way through the monarchy?
Oh,
and they changed it?
Yeesh, yeah, you know, that would be a very interesting, that would be a very different kind of movie. But every single thing that happens in that movie, down to like it starting in a picturesque countryside and then you're just on an island on the coast, like that could all very easily take place. The mother's, like, the prime minister? Or do you think she, like, the president was literally supposed to be the queen of England?
Well, I mean, if you want to take that to its logical conclusion,
I guess so. Yeah, I mean...
I don't know. I'm not saying I have nothing... I've read nothing to back that up.
You're spoiling the sequel right now, Garrett. The second one's going to take place in England.
You know, Seamus, please. Dude, please give me that.
I would not mind another Beekeeper movie. It ends in an open enough way.
I kind of love the ending. It's very abrupt, but the president wailing over her dead son and Jason Statham going into the sea.
Into the ocean to meet the Meg for his
like
ride
Godzilla.
Out of there.
Like, yeah. Well, I did what I had to do. Bye, everybody.
It's a very Point Break-y style thing with the FBI agent daughter of the nice old grandma lady. Again, they needed to fill some time. They couldn't have just back-to-back action scenes where Jason Statham is burning down call centers and stuff, but...
You know, the cop stuff was wacky enough for me. Her weird sidekick partner who...
Yeah, I didn't mind him as much.
Who, after he gets disarmed by Jason Statham and incapacitated, when they find him, goes to pick up his gun and goes, well, no, I guess that's evidence now. Like, I thought he was really funny, and they're trying to do this thing in the FBI office where... It's supposed to be, like, a crappy 70s, 80s FBI office where it's, like, water is dripping and stuff. And my biggest complaint about that was it was shot way too shot reverse. It was way too modern and digitally and cleanly shot to get that full aesthetic that they were going for. Kind of counterpoint to that, where you go over to the action, which overall is much more successful at... emulating the kind of, like, Jean-Claude Van Damme vehicles that this movie is clearly inspired by, down to, you know, the direct callback to Die Hard, where he starts the circular saw to lure a henchman over somewhere he wants them to be. So, you look at the gas station fight, where the new crazy beekeeper lady, which is probably the most John Wick-y this movie gets, comes to kill him, and... It starts the action sequence in a very grounded, in the blue hue of the gas station lighting. Mm. They're just, you know, it's more of a fist fight melee. And then it evolves into she's got her giant Gatling gun that's mounted in the back of her truck and is just going crazy, and it turns into a CGI explosion fest.
Yeah, it's a gasoline fight with a minigun in there, and she's, like, all purpled out, because that's her, like, thing, I guess. Mm-hmm. Beekeepers are just crazy people after Jason Statham.
Again, I feel like she's dressed like an 80s henchman, so I think that was kind of an intentional choice, but just like how the FBI subplot has kind of the choices and environment that you would associate with the kind of thing you would find in an 80s action movie... The visual storytelling is not cohesive with that, and not even the aesthetics necessarily are cohesive with that. And I think when you bounce back again to that gas station fight, which starts with the aesthetics of an 80s fight and then kind of ramps up into giant CGI gasoline and explosions...
We kind of get a better version of that henchman fight at the climax in the island with the South African... like, prosthetic leg dude who's like, oh, I killed the beekeeper. Oh, I got lucky. And then they do their hallway fight with every window in the world getting smashed over their heads. And it's, like, it's pretty fun because they get to, you know, they play around with his prosthetic leg a little bit. They're both, like, slicing each other up a lot. It's very much more analog than just, like, we're going to blow up this hallway with fire and gasoline or whatever.
I honestly don't know... Not since the Knife Museum in John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum has a guy gotten killed so viscerally in an action movie as Jason Statham shoving his knife several times into his chest, his neck, his throat, and up into the bottom of his head through his chin.
Yeah, all while already half of his face is, like, ripped open because he was shot through the face pre-fist fight. Like, it's a masterpiece. All the ingredients are there.
It's wild. It is absolutely... I really thought that Josh Hutcherson was going to get punished more than he did. He dies the cleanest, really.
Yeah, that is true. Every other person along the way, you know, fingers chopped off, thrown, driven off a bridge, lit on fire.
That guy
he just
died
knocks
pretty
a couple...
hard, too, yeah.
Oh. Bridge guy? Bridge dude, guy. I, like, felt bad for Bridge guy. Just didn't let him go with three less fingers and then waited until he was on a conveniently raising bridge before he executed him. It's wild.
It's crazy because they really show you what a bastard this guy is. They spend a long time at the beginning being like, look how much he loves stealing money. Look how much he loves ruining people's lives. Just so they can give him essentially two scenes in a row of comeuppance.
It's so scary. He appears like Batman and disappears like Batman in the barn where he chops his fingers off, and then reappears like Batman just in the middle of a highway road. Like, the dude would... It's fantastic. But, like you said, they really make these scammer guys, like, the world's biggest scumbags. Like, I almost don't feel that bad that Jason Statham is Michael Myers-style slaying them one by one.
It really is a Michael Myers thing. You and I said that to each other multiple times at and after our screening. It's crazy how much of a horror movie villain he is. Like, again, it's not like John Wick where it's like, look how cool and efficient John Wick is. Or not efficient in terms of, you know, throwing 15 knives into a guy's chest. But
he's hiding under a truck and the guy gets slid under and he snatches him into the truck and changes places with him. That's like horrifying and Looney Tunes funny at the same time.
You and I were losing our minds about that sequence.
That is right up to the line of too far, but it was so funny that I don't think either of us cared.
Because it's also a little bit Indiana Jonesy, which I think is why we loved it too.
Sure. But just the idea of like stuffing a man under a truck like he's a nerd in a locker. Just like grabbing him fully silently while surrounded by other guards. It's so good.
It's also insane to me this movie does literally no hand-wringing about killing FBI guys and SWAT teams.
Oh yeah, just like regular security guys that get like burned alive in that first building.
It's just, well, you're part of the problem.
You're in his way.
He usually gives them, like, one chance to let him do his thing. But they don't know who you are, Jason Statham.
They go, like, what is happening? I'm a beekeeper. That doesn't mean anything to me. And then he covers them in gasoline.
What's the most you ever lost in toin costs?
Christ.
And I said toin costs, and I'm leaving toin it costs. In. So,
hey, that's Statham for you.
But, like, he is Anton Chigurh. He's...
He might as well be dragging a gas tanker. I mean, he's lugging around those gas canisters almost like in the same way. It really is.
One thing that didn't make the movie that I saw, unless I just totally missed this, in the trailer, it's implied that he has honey explosives. And there's line of like one of the FBI guys going like, honey's flammable. Who knew? That I don't think made the movie at all.
Yeah, I definitely didn't pick any of that up. There's the one moment where he like pulls open a honeycomb and it like has a hard drive in it or whatever.
That's,
and like,
so
that's
rad.
I was into that for sure. Like, that's pretty awesome. But I'm not into it if it's like plastic explosive made out of beeswax or whatever. It's like, he loves those bees, damn it. He's a weirdo. Let him be a weirdo.
This movie lets him be a weirdo.
Yeah, and that's why I like he doesn't, you know, he has his spacesuit honeybee suit on at the beginning.
I wish he put that back on. I wish that had been in more of the movie.
For the island infiltration, he needs, like, a stealth suit. I mean, it very well could have been in a draft somewhere, but I kind of also like that he just has, a Carhartt jacket and a trucker hat on for 99% of the rest of the movie.
Yeah. After they massacre his bees with shotguns.
Oh, so sad. I was expecting, because we said it ends so abruptly, I was expecting a shot of like him rebuilding his beehives or something, like helping that old lady's estate in some way. I guess I don't know if he's gonna get to go do that, but the FBI lady seemed to not care.
No. Well, we get a bee flying along. That's the last image of the film.
Over the ocean for some reason.
Well, it's by all the pretty lake stuff, you know.
I guess that's true.
Stuff, whatever it is.
You know that I was ready for this to be like truly supernatural bee powers secret agent, but I'm very happy that it was not.
When I pitched this to you for the show, you were like, that movie where it's Bloodshot but with bees?
Yes, exactly. It was gonna be like, honey is his blood and he needs to like eat bees like the guy from Crank to stay alive. And he
Crank
has to go
3
kill the
buzzed?
Crank bee.
Yo.
Crank 3 Buzzed is actually pretty good, I'm gonna be honest.
Jeremy Irons doesn't Jeremy get Irons, enough to do. Yeah. I think that's like, he gets a couple of really good like villain monologues towards the beginning of the movie, and then gets his finger broken in the third act, and that's the it. And so I think you're right that he's likely coming back for a theoretical sequel.
Because the president is still alive, Jeremy Irons is still alive. They are pissed that, you know, homeboy got quick drawn on in there, even though he was just, like, super coked up and was going to murder-suicide the president.
Minnie Driver, who is the director of the CIA, I think, is in this movie for two scenes, and I feel like that is also kind of a backdoor setup for something larger.
Like, he is on the run. We get, like, truly, like, 10 seconds of him making contact with, like, the beekeeper agency.
Yeah.
And that looked super goofy, and I'm sure there's lore that they are thinking about for whatever that means for the next one.
That is kind of a calling card of, look at all this analog 80s technology that the beekeepers are still, well, it's digital, it's computers and stuff, but like old school 80s technology that the beekeepers use, and they have their weird uniforms, and I also don't think it's a coincidence that the way that sequence is shot looks a lot like when John McClane calls in the emergency over the radio in Die Hard.
Oh man, it definitely looks like that.
It's again this statement piece about, hey, you remember like 80s movies that were over the top mean with their violence? We're back to that.
And I'm here for it. They already set up like there is a lineage, a quote-unquote, of beekeeper agents, and they have no qualms being ordered to kill each other. They almost are kind of into it. Like, it's an honor to get into a fight with someone like Jason Statham in this universe. So that could, unfortunately, dip its toes into the John Wick Chapter 2 style of thing. Or was that 3? That was 3.
Both,
where all, it's like,
really?
I guess, yeah, they take place on, like, the same two nights. But then we have, you know, all the Chapter 3 stuff where it's like you have to get from warrior style from one end of the city to the other, and we have a bunch of colorful assassins in the way. Like, I think that is maybe on the right. Maybe we'll get a henchman that sticks around for more than a single fight scene in the next one. He can have a little bit of an adversary now that Hutcherson is gone, sadly.
But I like also in a way that they're not precious with their henchmen. It's not like, oh, they'll be back for the sequel. I do enjoy here we'll set this guy up as super competent, super scary. Are they a match for Statham? Absolutely not. Let them just get steamrolled.
I guess, it really is like a little mini-boss before we get to the main conflict in a way that doesn't feel, like you say, so precious. Like, at the end of that gas station fight and everything was going up in flames, I was like, oh, we're gonna see a purple-gloved hand, like, crawl out of the flames. But it's like, oh no, then there's just like a second bigger fire explosion that they're like, no, they're dead. They're so dead, it's insane.
It's also a very funny cut of him going from taking that guy's car, like literally next shot, the gas station blowing up, so that guy is just dead, maybe? Like random civilian man.
Yeah, he carjacked him, and then it lets that guy, like, full dead sprinted out of there in a single direction. He got exploded, along with everybody else who just might have happened to be in that gas station convenience store or something.
Yeah. I didn't see the gas station attendant run out when the firefight started, so...
Oh, yeah. He's leaving a wake of carnage, and it's kind of glorious. Like, the amount of charred buildings that the FBI agents show up, and they're just like, my God, this guy's insane. God, how could we ever be a match for this? And then just going to the next thing that he sets ablaze, it's kind of a blast.
I also do love at the beginning when he goes to the call center and he goes up to the receptionist of the building and he's like, tell everybody to evacuate and get out right now. And she's like, what? And he's like, no, everybody, sing it right now. I'm not joking around. She's like, okay, thanks.
Because, yeah, he has little bits of, you know, empathy here and there where he does give people that one chance. But I don't know. A couple of those security guard guys, they didn't really have a chance at all. I don't know.
No. Because the first two guys, he gives the unequivocal, do you know what they do here? Do you know how they ruin people's lives? And they're
sure,
like,
sure.
Beat it, pal! And then he just dispatches them. But
the
guys that come upstairs, they don't know what's going on. They just know there's a crazy guy shooting guns and stuff.
Yeah, their security job at the office has an intruder, and they're going up to, like, take this guy out of the building or whatever. And he's like, I'm so special ops that I'm gonna kill you before I kill you and then light your bodies on fire. It's crazy.
But I think, is that the beekeeper? Is that
a, I think that's the beekeeper. A very good time. I will definitively watch it again when it goes on Amazon Prime, I think.
Amazon Prime, because it has a weird, we didn't even talk about that. It had a weird production history where it didn't, even though it is an MGM thing. This movie had 1 million logos at the beginning. You and I were laughing at how many logos there were. Because we kept thinking it was the start of the movie, and then, nope, just so another logo.
Oh, so, eventually, when it is streaming, I'm going to watch this one again for sure.
Me too. I'm excited to return to the world of Clay, like from Die Hard, and the Beekeeper.
What do you say we talk about our pop culture reference this week?
Let's do it. For today's pop culture reference, we're going to be talking about Todd Howard. One of the most recognizable faces in today's gaming industry is designer, executive producer, and game director Todd Howard of Bethesda Game Studios. Howard began his career with Bethesda as a lower-level designer and producer for Terminator games Future Shock and Skynet in 95 and 96, but rose to the rank of project lead and original concept designer for 2003's The Elder Scrolls III: Morrowind, which was a commercial and critical smash hit. The Elder Scrolls V, Skyrim, was released in 2011. It would become the gold standard of Western RPGs for years to come, as Howard re-released it on every major console from the original PS3 and Xbox 360 versions all the way to current-gen consoles. Howard would even go as far as to develop a fully VR version of the 2016 Special Edition, and to really lean into the global joke of Skyrim being released on every piece of tech under the sun. The very special edition of the game was launched in 2018 for Amazon Alexa as a verbal command-based adventure.
Bethesda's shift to MMO live service games, with The Elder Scrolls Online and Fallout 76 in recent years, have given rise to even more criticisms of Todd Howard and his vision for the future of these beloved IPs. And the seemingly forgotten announcement of The Elder Scrolls 6 in 2018 only adds to the growing unease of the fans. Howard has been criticized even more recently with the release of the first new Bethesda IP in 25 years, Starfield. Many critics cite the undeniable similarities Starfield has to other iconic Bethesda titles like Fallout and The Elder Scrolls to highlight the stagnation that many fans feel coming from Bethesda game designs, and the empty-feeling open worlds that were previously boasted to be rich with content and dynamic NPC interactions left players very disappointed upon release. This week, Howard was revealed to be executive producing Bethesda's upcoming Indiana Jones and the Great Circle, developed by Machine Games. I feel like anybody who has had a console in the last 15 years has bumped into Skyrim at least a couple times, or heard Todd Howard's name from time to time when new announcements are made and he is, for whatever reason, always making them. It was a little weird to see his name in that Indiana Jones font for that new game coming out. You know, it doesn't look like it is going to be that crazy. It's definitely more of the Wolfenstein style of Bethesda things, so with Machine Games and all. So I think this one is going to be a little more safe than something like The Elder Scrolls or Fallout.
Did you know he was involved before the reveal trailer this week?
I guess, I mean, all the way back when we were talking about Indiana Jones exclusivity on Xbox and Bethesda being acquired by Microsoft, if I'm not mistaken, in general. Yeah. I think that we could have maybe guessed, but it is still weird to see it kind of come to fruition like that. To see his, you know, him talking to camera about how excited he is about stuff. A lot of times he gets, like we were mentioning in this read here, a little boastful about what he can accomplish as an executive producer. So I am, you know, fingers crossed that this will be a new chapter in things, because boy, oh boy, does Starfield look like garbo.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have some friends that play and enjoy it, so I don't know, maybe it's been patched enough that it's playable now, and I agree that it was very strange to see him, you know, stealing the idol from the background of the video promo.
This man had a major hand in things like Fallout 3 and Skyrim, like things that I actually do think are massively influential in my taste in video games. So it's not like I can say that he is like poison to a project, but I'm hoping it goes a little better than his more recent things that he's been a part of, at least.
And from what I was reading, he's been trying to pitch Lucasfilm a Indiana Jones game for the better part of 20 years. So he's got enough ideas and passion it that he wasn't just saying what every game developer says at the announcement of the game.
Right, we are going to keep an eye on Todd Howard and this game very closely, I think. So we will definitely bring this up again. But what do you say we wrap it up and go save the rec center?
Let's save it. Save the rec center! Now it's time to save the rec center, where we bring you our weekly recommendations. Seamus, what are you bringing in this week?
Well, I gave myself some breathing room because I did an actual movie last week. So the video game I'm playing this week, I've already mentioned this to you, is the World War II military sim Hell Let Loose, which I very regretfully missed on PS Plus about a year ago. It was on sale recently. I pulled the trigger. It has been the most frustrating and incredibly entertaining game online gaming experience I've had in a very, very long time. God knows I wasn't going to go into, like, Modern Warfare 3 or, you know, do any of the, like, Battlefield 2048 or whatever that one is called. I'm pretty much off of those big main franchise things, but Hell Let Loose is such a weirdly realistic, if you get tapped once, you're pretty much dead and you have to respawn and run, like, 15 real minutes across a recreation of a French village somewhere. It kind of sounds horrible when I describe it like that, but let me tell you, it's just the most satisfying when you can cooperate with your 50-person team, 50v50, it's absolute chaos, and truly some of the best use of the PlayStation 5 haptic feedback on the triggers that I have ever had the pleasure of playing with. So I very much recommend that to you, Garrett Strother.
I did catch this on PS Plus, and I have been looking for people who were also playing it to hop on with. So now that you are a convert, I think that is the sign.
It's such a weirdly role-specific game. It's like you have to have a spotter with your sniper in two-man teams. I think we could have a little fun with that.
That sounds like a good time. We're team pop culture reference. Go, yes. Go, go.
Yeah, we'll turn on our mics and just anyone who's near us will just be like, hey, check out our podcast, and then immediately get killed and kicked from the game. It'll be great. It'll be a blast.
I'm assuming there's friendly fire in Hell Let
Loose. Oh, 100%. Yeah, I've accidentally blown many of my friends' heads off just like trying to get an angle on somebody. It's very funny.
Oh, well, that sounds great.
But what do you have to save the rec center this week?
I'm going to keep it on theme with our news and Rec Center, a movie I watched 2 days ago, not knowing what was soon to come, Norman Jewison's The Original Thomas Crown Affair.
Oh!
It's a movie I've been meaning to watch for a long time. I am a fan of Jewison, obviously. I like Steve McQueen. Faye Dunaway is always good. I like heisty movies, and I didn't really know much about it other than it's super famous and iconic. So I checked it out and was blown away by the fact that it is both the most 60s movie I've ever seen, but also kind of a weird proto-70s movie with a lot of handheld camera work and very interesting on-location shooting that seems to predate. It's like a new wave film, I would say. And there are a lot of references that I did not get in Austin Powers until 2 days ago, let me tell you that, Seamus, because there are so many things where I was like, oh, so this is like just literally, because I was like, you know, it's the time, it's like the pastiche of the era, and I was like, no, this is just literally a scene from Austin Powers.
It's so funny, dude. That's very funny.
The use of split screen, which is a common 60s thing in general, I did not realize how innovative and exciting and truly bizarre the sequences could get with the use of split screen. Also, always glad to see Yaphet Kotto pop up in anything, even though he is barely in this movie.
Well, I've heard the name The Thomas Crown Affair for my entire life, pretty much. Probably people referencing the remake is usually what people are talking about.
Yeah, with the Pierce Brosnan, Rene Russo, which is directed by another great genre hopping journeyman, Martin Campbell. So I've never seen it, but I would like to.
Well, I've got two on my list, I think, because I know the very vague things about it, but I love how you're describing that 60s, 70s mashup of filmmaking right now. I think I'm going to have to check that one out first.
Please do.
But that wraps up our show this week. If you want to reach us on social media, you can hit us up at @PCR_podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. You can also find us on Facebook. And if you want to send us an email, that's popculturereferencepod@gmail.com.
Next week, we will be, in anticipation of Argylle, another whirlwind literary action-adventure film. A film that Seamus somehow has not seen, even though it's a certified classic. Romancing the Stone, directed by Robert Zemeckis, and starring Michael Douglas, Kathleen Turner, and Daniel DeVito.
I'm very excited. I know less than nothing about Romancing the Stone, except for that cast and how excited I am to see them all there. So I am looking forward to finally discovering this one.
I'm looking forward to talking it through with you. And everybody, we will see you next week.
Adios, beekeepers.
Gotta protect the hive.
Kill the queen, protect the hive.